Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your To Say What You Feel Is To Dig Your Own Grave of Music, News, and Criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica.
I know your answer already.
You're listening to the last day of our acquaintance. That is Sinead O'Connor. As I'm sure you know, Sinead O'Connor passed away a few days ago at 56. Sinead was a particularly idiosyncratic and unexpected pop force in the late 80s and early 90s. I'm sure you know Nothing Compares to You, which is a cover of a Prince-written song that became her biggest global hit. But Sinead had a number of really, really special albums, had a really unusual and powerful voice and vocal talent. And she had a career that was defined less by the aesthetics of her songs and more by the politics that she was passionate about and her personal journey, which is an overused term in pop, but really someone who was direct and open about her searching emotionally, personally, religiously, politically, and so on. And so on Popcast this week, we have two conversations. First, we're going to have Alfred Soto on, and we're going to get into Sinead's recording career. We're going to talk about the early work. We're going to talk about Sinead as a covers artist and really try to get into how Sinead deployed her very, very particular and unique voice in a way that both made sense in the pop mainstream and also destined her to exist somewhere outside of that. And then after that, Amanda Hess is going to call in. Amanda interviewed Sinead in 2021 when Sinead wrote her memoir. And we're going to get into Sinead, the person and the public figure, and how the public and the media did Sinead no favors, certainly in the early 90s during the SNL kerfuffle where she tore up the photo of the Pope on live television, and how that ended up shaping Sinead's career, not so much because she was blocked from ever being famous again, but because Sinead had made a choice that she would rather be the artist who does that than be the artist who continues to have pop music, quote unquote, success. So we'll get into that with Amanda. But for our first segment today, Alfred Soto is with us. Alfred, welcome. Welcome to Popcast, first time.
Thank you.
And as you reminded me, we had met at EMP many years ago when I still went to EMP. Shout out to everybody at EMP. And you still go to PopCon. So also shout out to everybody who still goes to PopCon. Can you just tell everybody briefly what's popping at PopCon these last few years? What's that like now?
Sure. Thank you. So the Pop Conference is a yearly clatch of rock critics, journalists, academics who write about music. It used to meet the EMP Museum in Seattle. During the pandemic, it went strictly online, and now it's in New York. It was in the Brooklyn School of Music, the Clive Davis School, in April. And it's still writing intelligently, still presenting intelligently about current trends in hip-hop, country, pop, etc.
I will say, for folks who are listening who are younger writers, or maybe younger college students or grad students, I found EMP really valuable when I was young. You really get exposed to a lot of different people working in the space, a lot of conflicting ideas, which was always nice, and conflicting in a way that's very different from online discourse. I do recommend checking out, I guess it's called PopCon now, but checking out the Pop Conference when it comes back around next year. Alfred is an assistant teaching professor at Florida International University, writes for Pitchfork, Billboard, has his own blog, which is where he's been writing about Sinead the last week or so, and why I invited him on today. I want to talk a little bit about, there are some obvious touch points about Sinead that people come back to a lot. Those are fine. I think we all know what they are. Nothing compares to you, the SNL appearance. Let's try to go a little bit past that, or even before that, and then beyond that. I wonder if you can talk to me about the first Sinead album and what she was doing that set the table for what was to come. But we're talking 1987 at this point. Tell me a little bit about that early Sinead work before she was on a lot of American radars.
It's remarkable to look back at the, if you look at the credits for The Lion, the Cobra, her 1987 debut, and it's a self-production. Kate Bush, just as a point of comparison, did not self-produce her first album. Sinead O'Connor did. And this was after months of wrangling with the producer, record company, Voice It on her. She first appeared on the radar as part of the extended U2 family. She collaborated with The Edge on a track called Captive for a soundtrack released in, I think, early 87. And she must have been, and might be slightly off, but I think about 20 years old. And she was already demonstrating a remarkable vocal range. And he wrote the music and she wrote the lyrics and the vocal melodies. And she owns this track. So by the time The Lion, the Cobra comes around, she was writing, she was experimenting with this motley mix of styles, right? She had stuff like I Want Your Hands on Me, which has some dance, even some hip-hop elements. And in fact, in the remix, she has MC Light, which is a amazing thing for a young Irish woman, 20 years old in 1987, to be so forward-thinking about.
You were barely getting hip-hop remixes on American R&B songs.
Exactly. And then her first real splash was on the track Mandinka. That was her first college radio hit. It's this guitar stomper with Adam Ant's Marco Peroni on guitar. And he became a crucial collaborator with her on those first two albums, co-writing a couple of songs too. And the other big track on The Lion of Cobra is called Troy. And that might be maybe still the most amazing demonstration of what the young Sinead O'Connor could do with her own material, and able to arrange that song to highlight all that was best and purest about her voice. It's this song based around William Butler Yeats's No Second Troy. And over 6 minutes, patiently, she explains why she was abandoned by her lover, why she will still remain a part of his life, yet there isn't a single instance of self-pity. Or it's almost like she's trying to harness her anger to center herself. And that kind of self-control was a hallmark always of Sinead O'Connor for at least two decades of her public career.
Let's listen to a little bit of Troy right now. It's really a really evocative track off this first album. This first album was noticed by whom? And in what context? You mentioned college radio. Kids, college radio was a thing that alternative musicians were heard in the late 80s into the 90s. Who was taking notice of this record? And how much of it was it moving outside of Ireland and Europe?
Interestingly, The Lion, the Cobra, it had its cult, but it also hit the American Top 40 album chart in 1988. And it was noticed by Grammy voters, because I think her first real public coming out in America was her performance of Bandinka at that 88 Grammys, which were held in 89, but it was the 88 ceremony. And she appeared as this 21-year-old young woman with a shaved head, with a combat boots, leading this guerrilla-style rock band behind her. I have no idea how Grammy voters would have responded, how they responded to her, but I know, and you can watch the YouTube clips, that the audience loved it. It was a real debut.
Yeah, the intensity of that performance, it's an imperfect comparison, but the jolt of the Brandi Carlile performance, like many, many, many years later, of this sudden like awakening of who is this person. Yes, she's on the stage, so she must be important, but we're not exactly sure why. There's something similar about the jolt of that early Sinead performance and the jolt of the Brandi Carlile performance, I find.
I would also say, and this is apples and oranges, but Ricky Martin in 1999 was also something like that. Who is this guy?
Right. And it's one of those things where you have to assess I've just not been paying attention. That's how it felt in frankly, all of those moments that we're talking about. Can we talk about Sinead's voice a little bit? Because in going back and listening to a lot of the early stuff over the last week or so, people talk a lot about the power of it. The thing that I kept returning to is the nimbleness of it. The way that she was able to move it very rapidly, pull it from high and from up loud to low, or vice versa, or jumping between notes in a really, really herky jerky, but very deft way. And it, as a vocal stylist, I was struggling to think of a real antecedent for that particular approach. It has elements of blues, it has elements of punk, it certainly is in keeping with a lot of folk traditions, some of the more mainline stuff, but I wonder if you can talk about how her voice was so particular, and not necessarily the songs, but the actual vocal.
What stands out about the early Sinead stuff, especially I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got, her real breakthrough in America, number one album, The One Nothing Compares to You, is that it seems to me as if she arranged the album around her voice's strengths. The album leads with this almost 7-minute track called Feel So Different, right? And has this conversational cadence, very different from what you hear on Mandinka or Troy. And then on the second side of that record, she has 1, 2, 3 tracks, one like bam, 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 all in a row, in which she experiments with a different style. A track called The Last Day of Our Acquaintance, it moves from a whisper to a scream. And the last track, the title track, is a cappella. And it sounds like a prayer. It sounds like something that a mother would have whispered to a child to try to get this boy or girl to go to sleep. And it's this husky, whiskery thing that is, again, 180 degrees removed from what you would hear on the rest of the album. And to have the kind of confidence to know how to give your voice the right kind of setting, that young stood out.
And I'm also very struck, people, I think especially young artists early in their careers, are often so preoccupied with trying to identify whether the sound or the scene that they fit into and bending or molding their voice to match the conventions of a pre-existing space. What I hear on the second album for sure, but also on the first album, is someone who it seemed already understood that there was not a pre-existing natural home for her specific vocal talent. And so was trying to do as many different things as possible, pulling in many different directions and pulling from a number of different influences.
Yeah, she's paradoxical in that usually a lot of young artists, to your point, are looking for the first couple of records are the sum total of their influences, right? And so on one hand, she's listening to Prince. She covers Prince, right? She's working with Adam Ant's guitarist. That's her background. She worked with The Edge. But on the other hand, she recognized that her voice had no traditions other than what you might hear in a Catholic church's choir. She almost had to write the songs and produce the songs so that she could find a natural home for that voice. But at the same time, she's channeling almost 100 years worth of vocal traditions through her larynx.
When I think of the way that Sinead made her impression in the late 80s and early 90s, obviously, and we're not going to avoid playing Nothing Compares to You. So let's play Nothing Compares to You. Let's listen to it for just a moment.
All the flowers that you planted, mama, in the backyard, all died and went away.
So there's some portion of it that's obviously the video, the look, the appearance, the glare almost, but it's really, to me, how the voice moves through space, how atypical it was considering what else was happening in pop and rock at that time. And even, you know, you mentioned sort of coming out of whether the U2 ecosystem or covering a Prince composition. And yet in her voice, and we'll talk about cover songs in a bit, but in her voice, they become totally denatured. All that influence becomes totally denatured.
That's a really good way of putting it. And you can't take away the key name on that credit. Co-producing it is Nellie Hooper. And for the audience who doesn't know who Nellie Hooper is, he was Soul to Soul's co-producer and then later on went on to work with Massive Attack. And to my ears, it sounds like a proto-Massive Attack track. But even sparer than what Massive Attack would come up with in 1990 and 91 with their debut Blue Lines. And I have to say, that's probably her influence. It's these string lines. There's really no embellishments. Like you said, the spareness was very much not like what spring 1990 sounded like, the era of Janet Jackson's Escapade, for instance.
Another great record,
but on the other end of the spectrum.
But yet and still, this record is rapturously received. This is a hallmark record of the year. Can you tell me a little bit about what this record achieves outside of Nothing Compares to You?
It kept having hits, right? The second single is The Emperor's New Clothes, which unfortunately was not a top 40 hit. She is a one hit wonder in America, alas. But it's this driving rock track. And I can't think of another moment in a artist that young where sanctimony was so sunny. She's already telling her critics to piss off, and she grounds it in this conversational vocal melody, and then has the confidence to end with this minute long, maybe longer than a minute, outro, where she just lets the band take it away. And anyone who watched MTV that summer, 1990, knows the video. It's this, all these jump cuts as Sinead is dancing to the rhythm. And it should have been to me a smash, and in some ways I prefer it to Nothing Compares to You, because it's a less palatable message, let's put it that way.
It's a less palatable message, although it is delivered, I would say, in a slightly more palatable or recognizable package.
True.
But message wise, I absolutely agree. Way more. If you can't see at home, I'm wagging my finger. Can't see. I also want to talk about Black Boys on Mopeds. Let's listen to that.
These are dangerous days. Say what you feel is today your own grave. Remember what I told you.
The thing about Sinead, her engagements with Black music, with Black American music, you mentioned the MC Light collaboration earlier, were, I believe, rooted in an aesthetic appreciation, but also in a real political level of engagement with Black culture. And having a song like this, touching upon police mistreatment of the Black community, this is something that, you know, white performers don't do in 2023, to say nothing of 1990.
And it's remarkable also, as it's a testament to how generous she was as a performer, how empathetic she was, that she's able to make these we's resound as an I, right? I mean, she has that key line, these are dangerous days, to say what you feel is to dig your own grave. How prophetic that would be in her own career, right? And as it is not to say that what happened to Colin Roach, the teen killed, about whom the song the song is about, but she's able to both universalize it and particularize it. And it's also this protest against Thatcher's Britain and what Thatcher has done to people of color and how that attitude persists. And as someone who was Irish herself, she understands what colonialist England did to press its heels against people under its subjugation.
At the same time that she was putting out songs like this, to what degree was she speaking openly about these issues? Obviously, we know what happened on SNL in 1992. In the Irish press, in the British press, in the American press, how open was she about the actual politics that she was trying to bring into her art?
There's a Spin magazine interview. I can't give you the month. It's about fall 1991. And she speaks openly about the Catholic Church and its history of sexual abuse. And the quote I never forgot, because I was 17, 18 when it came out, and I was myself a Catholic school, high school student. She says, "The church has no business discussing sex in the first place because they don't have sex. In the second place because they have sex." And wow, what a great song lyric that would have been, right? But it's, and that was at least a decade before what we know about what the Catholic orphanages had done in Ireland. So she knew. She knew she was, she lived in what was in essence a theocracy when she was a child. So she could speak the power in that capacity.
Okay, I've got a question about covers. We're going to come back in just a moment. We're going to take a break.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back with Alfred Soto. We're talking Sinead O'Connor. Alfred, can we talk about covers for a minute? Nothing Compares to You, that's a cover. Her performance of War on SNL that preceded the Pope photo being torn up, that's a cover. On your blog, you put a list of important or meaningful or powerful Sinead covers. What do you think she saw in the act of covering a song that she was able to deploy and weaponize to her power?
There is no method to covering, right? Every good covers artist knows how to, you know, from Nilsson or Brian Ferry or Michael Bublé, they have an approach. I think what Sinead O'Connor was able to do was she didn't surrender to the material. She absorbed it and it sort of melted in her, like the way that lava melts stuff on a hillside, right? And I always come back to a cover of Elton John's Sacrifice, which appeared on the Two Rooms compilation of artists covering Elton John, Bernie Taupin songs. And the original Elton John song is this, it's buried in this very 89 arrangement. Not that there's anything wrong with it. What Sinead does is strip it bare, unearths the melody, and is able to make it, in essence, a sequel to Troy, right? After you've burned down the house, what is left? And the lyric of Sacrifice speaks to that kind of, what do we have left? What do you want? What do you want from me? And I'm also taken with this pretty obscure cover she did about 10, 12 years later of the B-52s' Ain't It a Shame. It appeared on the last album they recorded with Ricky Wilson, their key member, the guitarist, songwriter who died of AIDS in 85, 86. And it's a song by Cindy Wilson in which she mourns how her boyfriend pays more attention to the TV and video games than he does to her. A situation that is as contemporary in 1986 as it is in 2023. She turns into this punky, it's the opposite of sacrifice. She punks it up. It's all these power chords. And unlike the Sidney Wilson version, which turns it into the sort of act of resignation, she gives it this anger, like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to me? I will not. It's almost like she wants to shake him. And the way, again, she's able to find a Sinead O'Connor approach to the song, she's able always to personalize it. She's in essence a song stylist, is what distinguishes her.
Let's listen to that. I'm not familiar with that cover. I'd love to hear a little bit of it. Let's listen to Sinead O'Connor cover the B-52s.
Flying saucers could land, and it wouldn't make much difference to my man. I could walk aboard and thank the Lord.
We're in an interesting moment of hyper-referential pop music, whether in the form of covers or obvious samples, so on and so forth. You know, we've talked on Popcast Deluxe about the Luke Combs, Tracy Chapman cover recently and how rote and AI that almost feels. It doesn't really seem to have a lot to do with Luke Combs at the end of the day. It's just a faithful rendition. But the thing that I hear in these Sinead covers is, maybe this is just me reflecting my own experience, but sometimes you live so deeply inside of a song that the song becomes, it's no longer a finished product. You've broken it down for parts, taken what you needed from it, and carried that with you. And then she seems to be taking the next logical step from there, which is, okay, I've taken the part that I need. How do I then make it a part of what I am in the world? How do I actually add it to my arsenal, as it were? And that's rare, because I think some people, I think, would say that takes hubris, but I don't see it as hubris. I see it as a kind of a real being truly in touch emotionally with your source material and also knowing how it connects to the gift that you have. It's not remaking or disrespecting an earlier version. It's literally just acknowledging the strength of something, absorbing it, and then putting it back in the world in your own language.
Yeah, she sets afire these self-help bromides, right? She has no interest in them. All her cover choices, they're almost like thesis statements, and she's able to inhabit them and develop them as you would any good thesis statement. I'm also taken with this cover of John Grant's Queen of Denmark, released about 10 years ago. John Grant is this solo queer artist who's written a number of gay-specific love songs with this sort of ironic attitude. Queen of Denmark has this line, "I wanted to change the world, but I could not even change my underwear." And Sinead is able to give that line the humor and the seriousness, that paradox again, that it requires, right? Because she understands that you can only be funny about serious things.
Completely. And that the ability to be funny about a serious thing connotes that you have, in my mind, that you have given it the gravity of its seriousness and then been able to triumph over or move beyond or see an alternate perspective on it.
That's the point that a lot of scolds miss.
Yeah. A lot of points missed by scolds. Just as close listeners of Popcast will know, we have no time for scolds who miss points. Can we talk a tiny bit about Sinead in the aftermath of SNL? Obviously kept putting out records for a few years, maybe has five or so albums that came out over the next 10 to 15 years. But I think sometimes the term I'll use is right-sizing. She right-sized her career a little bit. She didn't want to be a pop star with the obligations that come with pop stardom. And so she self-torpedoed, but in a way that was sincere to her. What kind of music did that free her to make? Do you find the music on the subsequent albums, especially those two subsequent albums, radically different from the music on the first two albums? Or do you feel like the music was the same, it's just that people's attention was shunted elsewhere?
I think that's right, your latter point. I think she made the two albums she wanted to make. The album she was promoting when she won on SNL was Am I Not Your Girl, a covers album. And it's hard for listeners now to understand how weird that gesture was in 1992 for an artist at the peak of her career to release a covers album? That's natural now, not then. And it was natural in the 70s. You think of Brian Ferry again and Bowie. She was able to, once again, I don't think it's a total success. That's probably for me her most mixed results of that period. But if I'm going to hear Don't Cry For Me Argentina, I'm going to hear Sinead O'Connor's, not Madonna's. Madonna's cover sounds like the self-righteousness that Sinead's critics accuse her of being. Whereas Don't Cry For Me Argentina, sung by Sinead, sounds like someone almost anticipating the criticism she'd get for the SNL performance. I'm also taken with Universal Mother, her 1994 album, which is a mix of covers and self-written material. She is in her own league here. Nothing in 94 sounds like what she put together on that record. It's a real curate's egg thing. She has a cover of Nirvana's All Apologies. I think directly addresses what happened with SNL, and I think the lyric is self-explanatory. She has this collaboration with Bomb the Bass called Fire on Babylon that is just amazing. Maybe to me, one of the best like electro bass lines of the 90s. I had alluded to Massive Attack earlier with Nothing Compares to You. She would work with Massive Attack again a decade later in 2002, and she was totally conversant with electro dub, and because her voice was so protean, she could adapt herself to any musical context and make it and particularize it, make it her own.
Is it a pushback against the I do not want what I haven't got success to say I'm going to give you less of me, even though Sinead is a signature covers performer? But is there something about that that was a little bit like I'm going to remove myself a tiny bit from the equation?
When she covers, you know, I Want to Be Loved by You or Secret Love or Bewitched, Bothered and Bewildered, years before the swing revival, by the way, she is almost saying, this is another side of me. These songs are as much me as Mandinka or Troy or The Emperor's New Clothes. I was listening to my mother's vinyl collection as much as I was listening to the punk stuff from which I drew so much influence. So it's all of a piece. And you're totally right. It is a way to put some space between what she had created in the first two albums.
I feel like so much of those first two Sinead albums felt like explicit rejection of vocal approaches that had dominated the 80s. But I don't know that there was a total musical cohesion. And I don't mean that in a negative way, just that the musical answer to that time period is not as thoroughgoing as the vocal answer to that time period. And I do think on some level, the arrival of Massive Attack and groups like that, that's where the musical answer to that time period really starts to coalesce.
Yeah. And I think a crucial bridge album is Nena Cherry's Raw Like Sushi, released in 1989 between The Lion, the Cobra and I Do Not Want What I Haven't Got. And she was an early Massive Attack collaborator and a beneficiary of their productions. And not to say what Sinead O'Connor did wasn't original, but there's a sense in which they were all operating the same sort of fecund ground here. There was something going on in England and Ireland, cross-pollination that made it a really exciting time, and certainly a rejection of what was going on in America vocally.
Before we go, is there a late period Sinead, whether from one of the more recent albums or even just one of the 90s or early 2000 albums that really sticks with you as something novel or unusual or very potent Sinead on her level?
I am a fan of her 2012 album, How About I Be Me and You Be You? And it's a return to, again, writing her own tunes. And it sounds, I remember when I heard it, I had not listened to her in a long time. It felt like listening to an old friend, someone you hadn't hung out with in a while, having a beer with. And it was, how are you? And it was a 2012 Sinead O'Connor record, guitar heavy, with some mild dub experiments. The John Grant cover's on there. And if she sounded great. Her vocals were on their game. The material was fine. And she only released one more self-written album after that in 2014. And I wish there had been more. Give me more Sinead O'Connor tracks in the vaults, please.
What's a good track we should go out with from this How About I Be Me album?
The Wolf Is Getting Married, a return to collaborating with Marco Peroni.
This is The Wolf Is Getting Married. Alfred, I appreciate you. We're going to check out this song. We'll be back in a moment with Amanda Hess. But
This podcast is supported by Nutrafol. Hair thinning is never just about your hair. It could be your job or your deodorant or your lunch or just normal life. That's why our whole body approach targets key root causes of hair thinning. And my Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand. Discover your root causes at Nutrafol.com. That's Nutrafol.com. These statements have not been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Paid for by Nutraceutical Wellness, Inc.
Amanda Hess is here. Amanda, bienvenue to Popcast After Almost Dark.
Thank you so much for having me, John. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
I'm excited that you're here, even though the circumstances are really rough. In 2021, still COVID era, maybe like just after vaccine wave one, but you spoke with Sinead, pegged to her memoir coming out, Rememberings. And that was a video interview, if I remember correctly, right? You didn't travel. It was a classic COVID era interview.
Yeah, it was like hours on Zoom. That was the time.
Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, like why did you want to profile Sinead? Like what sort of drew you to her as a figure to profile?
So I didn't know that much about her. When she ripped up the Pope photo on SNL, I was like 7 years old, I think, in 1992. And so I had always known about her. And she was kind of like a part of the pop culture water that I had been drinking. But there was so much that I didn't know. And so when I started to read her book, I was really fascinated by the way that she contextualized that moment. We're like, I think we're pretty used to now, like recontextualizing women who have been wronged in pop culture. But the way that she put it felt very new to me and so interesting, which was not, I did something provocative and I was mistreated for it. It was, I did something provocative and it derailed my career. And that was a wonderful thing.
What a relief.
This embrace of not being seen as a respectable pop star was so fascinating to me. And so it's not always that you read a celebrity's memoir and you're like, it's so fascinating. And so I just felt like the book gave me so much to work with that I really just wanted to talk to her and talk. She seemed like someone who would be interesting to talk to about her own image and how she saw that image being made and how that image squared with her experience of being a person.
And also one of the things that I think has been so striking about Sinead over the years subsequent to the early 90s is here's a person who is remaking her own image multiple times in real time, in public, in a very, these are overused words, but in a very fearless way. And I one of the anecdotes that has always struck me about Sinead over the years is having a meeting with her A&R person very early on in her career and saying, oh, you should dress a little bit more feminine. You should be a little bit more womanly. And immediately she goes to the barber and cuts her hair off. So here's a person who is extremely interested in controlling her own narrative. And you can say, some would say to her peril, but as you point out, and as she points out in the memoir, really to her own liberation.
Right. I mean, I think it was both. The way that she described it was like, she grew up with a mother who was incredibly physically and emotionally abusive, tried to kill her. She writes in the book, just a horrible upbringing of child abuse. And she describes sort of like going from this identity crisis of being abused as a child to this identity crisis of suddenly being like an incredibly famous person. And so I think she was always really grappling with that. Like the anecdote that you just told speaks to someone who is just an iconic artist, right? Someone who is interested in her image and interested in owning her image. Somebody who you could imagine like becoming incredibly famous, but then someone who really, really struggled with what that meant for her life. And the other thing that really drew me to her story was that her image had been in recent years so determined by her mental illness And she had posted a live video on Facebook a few years earlier where she was talking about being in crisis. She got mixed up with Dr. Phil, who put her in a facility and interviewed her on his show.
Yeah, very baffling and distressing turn of events at the time. Really, really rough to watch.
Yeah. And I was interested in like how we talk about women with mental illness and how it's something that is not just a literal diagnosis, but also a cultural diagnosis and something that we use to silence women. And even as we make them into more and more of a spectacle. So I was really curious with just what that was like for her as someone who was so admirably open and honest about what she was going through, but also, again, saw that openness and vulnerability taken advantage of by Hollywood. And so that interested me.
We've both interviewed a number of people over the years, and I think you experience, especially when you're interviewing a famous person, some percent or some degree of barrier, some degree of self-mythology. Oftentimes I find myself, I feel like I'm interviewing like a person's idea of their own narrative more than a person. But one thing I'm struck by in a number of the remembrances, especially from journalists on Twitter in the last few days, and this comes up in your story, and also there was a profile of Sinead maybe 10 years prior in the Times by Ravi Somaiya. It does not feel like that barrier or filter was there. And I wonder if, just on a very basic discursive level, what was it like to converse with this person who seems to not want to put up, or maybe is not able to put up, those barriers? What was your experience of that like?
That was definitely my experience with her. Going into the interview, I spoke with a representative of hers before the interview who had said, you know, I just wanted to give you a couple of heads up before the interview starts. I had read her memoir and I was told that Sinead was not super interested in discussing her mother and she didn't really want to talk about mental illness. And I was like, okay, I don't have to ask about her mom, but I do think I should talk to her about the other stuff. And so I didn't bring it up right away. First, we talked about what it was like for her to be watching TV alone in her home that was like between the mountains and the sea in Ireland.
Also, her imaginary boyfriend, Tay Diggs. Great detail. Great.
Yeah.
Incredible
detail.
She
later sent me an email that was just a gigantic photograph of Tay Diggs saying, can you blame me? And I couldn't. So it was very much a COVID era, like kind of introduction to her because we had all been living this kind of life. But she was talking about how loneliness at that point in her life really suited her and how she was really enjoying being alone. And later, we did talk about mental illness a lot and we talked about it in this kind of meta context. But again, it wasn't like what you're describing where it's like she's mythologizing. It's like we were talking about her image and she did seem to have a very astute idea of what people were thinking of her all the time. But she did not seem particularly interested in doing anything to sway it one way or another. She just wanted to like be an artist. And so yeah, she ended up being very, very comfortable talking about mental illness. And it was because I think we were talking about how it was a narrative that became a part of her image and a part of her life. And we were not talking about things like her experience with her mother that she describes in the book that were still, it was my understanding at the time, incredibly triggering for her and incredibly difficult for her to talk about. So we were like walking this line of always talking about Sinead, the 50-something woman who's living alone on her mountaintop, and Sinead, the celebrity image who comes and intrudes on her life once in a while. Those were the two kind of Sineads that we were talking about.
From your piece, one thing I remember is that she wrote the book sort of in two different time periods. She wrote it. She started working on it maybe in the early 2010s, then had a period of real struggles with her mental health, and then returned to it. Did you get the sense that ultimately the process of writing it and putting it in the world was serving some cathartic benefit for her? Because some people would find that re-triggering. It could go any number of ways. And I wonder how she talked to you about the actual act of committing to those memories and walking through them, not burying them, but walking through them.
Yeah, I did get the sense that it was a very productive experience for her. It took many years to finish. And reading the book, you can see a kind of before and after where the narrative starts to dissolve a little bit after she had a hysterectomy and had some like really difficult experiences after that. However, the experience of promoting the book, which, you know, I was a part of.
Oh, yeah.
I think was very difficult for her because it was this renewed scrutiny from journalists, from the public. And I know that there were things that were difficult for her to talk about.
One of the things that you mentioned is in the last few years, especially, we do seem to be in a period of the media reevaluating how it's treated people in the past, particularly women, female celebrities. People have been subjected to an extraordinarily harsh spotlight, unforgiving perspective. Where do you think the Sinead O'Connor narrative fits in with some of these other ones that have been brought back to the fore in the last few years? To me, it feels a little bit different, but I wonder how it lines up for you in the broader context.
Something I think about all of those stories is that sometimes they're written as if these events happened today, it would have been different. And I don't think that they necessarily would have been, because we're not a monoculture. And so there are like entities, like conservative entities, that would still be incredibly, incredibly upset if a person ripped up a photo of the Pope on live television. It's still an incredibly provocative thing to do. And I don't know that she necessarily would have been treated differently. I also think when it comes to reexamining her as a person who has mental illness, like we're in this moment that feels like it wants to be very progressive about embracing people who have mental illness. But a lot of times I think the discourse is much more comfortable with mental health. So they're comfortable talking about people who have experienced mental illness but are all better now and act completely normatively, never do anything unpredictable, drink a green juice, whatever. And so
wow.
part of what I wanted to do with the story was to suggest that her mental illness was not inconsistent with her being somebody who was an incredibly influential artist still, and someone who was still worth listening to, and that she didn't need to be in complete recovery in order to be a serious person.
Because I feel like these things, even if you look at something like the Britney Spears narrative, I felt like there was this need to say she's arrived on the other side of whatever had been going on. But of course, it's never quite that clean. It's never quite that orderly. And mental illness, people who struggle with mental illness could go in and out degrees over long stretches of time. And one of the things that I find fascinating about the Sinead story is, unlike, say, the Britney narrative, where I feel like the media is constantly trying to say it's either done, it's completed, she's healed or not. I feel like Sinead has constantly, sometimes in a really difficult way, announced, taking the lead on the discourse rather than letting the discourse define her. There's a bravery in that. There's something that's especially for someone who has been pummeled so mercilessly in the media, just continually put yourself out there, be vulnerable, be public. That to me seems like an incredibly bold choice. I wonder, when you were speaking with her, was there any stretch of that conversation where you can sense anxiety or regrets, maybe a strong word, but some kind of reticence about the degree of openness that she either was giving you specifically or had given over many, many years?
Yes. I emailed with her a lot, like between, we spoke twice over Zoom, and I emailed with her between those conversations and then afterwards. And this is, I think, actually a very typical feeling to have, but not one that a celebrity will necessarily express to you. She was nervous about many of the things that she had said, worried about how she came off. And we talked about those things. It's our job is not to do publicity for an artist. But at the same time, I really did not want to misrepresent Sinead in the story. I don't interview people for national security stories where they're like, oops, I slipped up and said something really messed up. And so I tend to feel like the first way that someone describes something or describes themselves is sometimes the most honest way, and sometimes it's not. And sometimes it's the most accurate way of making sense of them, and sometimes it's not. So I did take that stuff into consideration as I was writing about her.
I also think, and I have found this with different kinds of interview subjects, some who I find to be manipulators and some who I find to be very vulnerable. But one thing that I have found over the years is, there's a flattening that happens when you put someone's very raw words on the piece of paper in the New York Times specifically. And I find sometimes you have to, as a writer, as a profiler, find a way to not simply faithfully render the words, but to explain the context and the tone and the tenor, which as often as not, and maybe more often, is more important than the specific 10-word quote. The how the quote was delivered, in what context, all of those things need to be communicated. And I imagine for Sinead, who is speaking very frankly and then is also anxious about having spoken frankly, part of what you are tasked with is, how do you communicate that in a way where the quote is not necessarily the thing, but the entire delivery of the vulnerability? That's really what you're trying to get across. It sounds like it's sort of what you're alluding to.
And I think one thing that surprised me about her is how incredibly funny she is. We just had a very jokey conversation. And I think she's someone who, at least the way that I had absorbed her image, it was something that I think was presented as very self-serious. And she takes herself seriously. And then she thought that she had something to say. I really loved the way she put it, which was, she felt that she deserved to be listened to, not because she was a celebrity, but because she was a human being. But she was also like an incredibly, incredibly funny person. And I tried to make sure that came across too. I also, you know, I spoke with several of her friends and collaborators. And when I talked to Bob Geldof, he said something that I thought was incredibly endearing, which was, she can say whatever she wants about me or my wife. It doesn't matter because she's Sinead. And he was incredibly protective of her. When I was doing the interview, in my mind, I was thinking, what did she say about your wife? Which I had no, it wasn't like I said, Bob, I heard that she said this about you and your wife. What's your response? This was something that just came out of nowhere, maybe out of like an assumption that I knew more about their relationship that I'm sure has been in the press than I did know. And the thing is, it's like what he said, it doesn't matter what it was that he was referring to. It was this sentiment that I thought was so refreshing, and was able to kind of like, even when no one writing the story or reading the story knows what was said, it's about recontextualizing something that might in another context, especially like in the tabloid context of the UK, be made into a feud when this is like an incredibly long and complex friendship.
And someone who speaks in as unguarded a manner as Sinead spoke is not optimally suited to this particular media climate. which is very much parsing down to the tiniest details, splitting everything up, focused on conflict. Like, that, this is not, it was a cruel world 25, 30 years ago for her. The specifics of the cruelty, I think, have changed, but it is equally cruel to someone who speaks like that.
And that's why I think I felt so lucky that our interview was around her book, because I did have this kind of North Star of things that she said and believes and published. And I think that's really helpful to kind of like have, not that it's the entire basis of my understanding of the person, but that I have a really clear basis of how she wanted to be seen at that moment.
Did she talk at all about religion, or did you guys talk about religion very much? Because that was something I'm sort of curious about, and then her shifts, being ordained and then converting. Did that come up at all?
We did talk about religion a little bit, and I was struck by, not that she wasn't serious about it, because it was a big part of her life, but that she was part of her image, that it was like Sinead O'Connor has taken on a new religion and now she is Jewish, or she's taken on a new religion and now she's a practicing Muslim. And each of them came with a new name. And I felt those changes had maybe been overemphasized in the making of her image, in that it seems like this incredibly, again, dramatic and self-serious thing. Whereas when we spoke, she seemed like someone who had been raised Catholic, obviously, had felt cast out of this religion, had felt completely misserved by the Catholic Church, but wanted to be close
both
to God.
On a micro and macro level, it seems, the specifics of her mother's relationship to Catholicism, and also obviously the systemic abuses that she was protesting on SNL.
Yeah, and I think at the time it wasn't recognized how personal her gesture was, and that this photograph of the Pope had been taken down from her mother's wall. And when I talked to her about it, she was like, oh, that's kind of my bad. You know, maybe I didn't make that totally clear. But the same was similar with her. Sort of, she seemed like someone who was very interested in being close to God and examining a bunch of different religions, and that she still had a bunch of iconography in her house from various religions. She was wearing like a ring with a Jewish star, and that she had taken for herself what was helpful. So it was less a kind of very strict taking up and putting down. It was something that was evolving.
And also, I think professions of faith or discovering one's relationship to faith, it felt very much of a piece with someone who had been very, very, very publicly displaying, whether it's their personal traumas or expressing through music or through action, someone who was unafraid to say, I'm grappling, and then to have that, like you say, I think people tend to think of these conversion experiences as extremely serious. Like it's a rejection of your old life and you've like a hard pivot into a new direction. But it didn't feel exactly that. It didn't feel exactly that way when she would talk about it.
Yeah, it didn't seem that way to me at the time that I spoke with her. I feel like the most emotional experience that I had writing the story about her came after the story was published. And it was when I heard from so many people about her. People who wanted to be close to her, wanted me to forward emails to her, wanted me to send images to her, messages. I got phone calls from people who were like desperate for me to put her in touch with their cousin who was struggling. And it was actually quite overwhelming to me. Just the volume of responses that I got of people who were trying to get one step closer to Sinead O'Connor. Then I had to say, I'm so sorry, it would be inappropriate for me to even ask to put you in touch with her. And I felt in that moment, after the story was published, I got just this tiny sliver of an experience of what it must be like to be her, where she's so culturally significant. She's so artistically significant. She's so emotionally significant to so many people. I found it really difficult to deal with. And I was in awe of her ability to shoulder just all of this.
That reminds me of something towards the end of your story. She's moved to this small town. She finally has a sort of group of female friends, which she hadn't had in a really long time. And they're all seem inclined to protect her. Even there was a story that we ran not long after her death, where they interview people who lived in that, I believe, in that same town, all of whom were still very much, even though she didn't live there maybe anymore, but they're very, very protective. But she says something at the end that I found really, really powerful and layered, which is, we bury bodies for each other. And that it sort of, it's leaving me speechless now. It's a testament to obviously how close these people were with each other, but also a sense of what true friendship really can be, and also how intense one's needs can be, how heavy those needs can feel, and be, and the demands that they might ask of others are very, very elegant and also like portentous thing for her to say.
Sinead was extremely generous with me, with her time, and with putting me in touch with her friends, like many famous people. And I asked her if I could speak with one of her lady friends from the mountain, and she said, absolutely not. Which is, I think, lovely that she had something that was just for her. And I think that's nice.
Yeah, we should all have that.
Yeah.
Amanda, I appreciate you. Thanks for coming on and chatting, Sinead.
Thank you so much. It was really nice to be able to talk about her.
And that is our show on Sinead O'Connor. Thank you to Alfred Soto. Thank you to Amanda Hess. Listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. That also includes Podcast Deluxe, recently named by Vulture as the best New York Times podcast. Podcast in general as the best New York Times. Anyway, Podcast Deluxe is on YouTube. Go check that out. The audio is also on our audio stream. You can get podcasts anywhere you get your audio content. That is Apple, Spotify, Pandora, etc. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get in the Discord. Get in the Facebook group, tinyurl.com/podcastdiscord or /podcastfacebook. Buy the t-shirts and the stickers. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with a personal Sinead favorite of mine. This is from 1990. I am stretched on your grave.